Yes, we are, and it's 5, 4, 3, I'm losing my hair, 2, 1.
Hey, Alex Simmons, what's up? We're here again with Tell the Damn Story, the podcast YouTube show that tells you about writing experiences so that your journey is a little easier. And we have a lot to tell today, so I'm not going to catch up with Alex so much. We have three guests with us today. All of them have been generous enough to participate in Soul Scream Anthologine, a 5, eventually 6-volume experiment in celebrating the beauty of hybrid horror and how horror just embraces everything. So we're going to have a little bit of reading, a little bit of conversation, and hopefully there's some stuff in there that you'll be able to take with you to make your writing journey a little bit easier.
There's going to be gems. There's going to be pearls. There's going to be
pearls. There's going to be gems.
It's just going to
be
great.
Gems of pearls, ladies
gems
and gentlemen.
Gems and pearls, yes.
And
what we do.
That's right. Whatever we don't do that. Right. All right. And we're gonna start with our...
Introducing everybody.
Yes, we're going to introduce everybody. Yeah. We have... Coming back from last week, the often published legend of pulp and horror and adventure stories, Teal James Glenn.
Yay!
There he is, Teal. And then we have representing the entire South.
In the right corner. Yeah.
Pulp legend. His new book is Snow Hunt from the Snow series. There are so many things to read from Bobby Nash. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Bobby Nash.
Yeah, Bobby.
Hey, hey.
And then we have Randy Dawn. Oh, my God. Randy Dawn has done journalism, has done pop culture journalism, has done writing. Her latest book is Tune In Tomorrow. It is a great fantasy romp that if you haven't checked it out yet, go and give it a little
I haven't
peek.
Checked it
There's
out yet,
Randy Dawn. Say hello, Randy.
Hello, Randy.
There you go. Oh, all right. These three represent very different styles that they submitted to Soul Scream. Our anthologine is part anthology, part magazine, all hybrid horror. There it is. It celebrates that horror will let you go anywhere. And tonight you're going to see what I mean.
And we're going to talk about that too, aren't we, Chris? After the reading,
after we're going to just talk about everything.
Yeah, we're going to talk about it. So people are going to, they're going to get a little bit, a little taste of each of these stories from these wonderful writers. And then we're going to talk about Soul Scream so people have an idea of what that really is. Because an anthologine, I believe, as Teal put it, is your word, Chris.
Yep.
Yes, your creation.
All right. So,
right, here we go.
The blue, our Led Zeppelin 4 of the collection, no subtitle, the Blue South Soul Scream Anthologine. We have the one and only Bobby Nash, a writer of so many things. But in this series, he submitted his 2 different stories from his Crimson project. And Bobby, take it away. Let's get a little taste of Charity and Samson, bro.
Yes, they do appear in both of these editions. I'm going to actually read from the newer one.
Cool.
Charity and Samson are characters I had the story in the first volume I had written elsewhere once before, and that project fell through. So it's nice to come back, and the story in here is the first time I've written them in a number of years. So it was really great to get back and reintroduce myself to these characters. Charity is a vampire who has this miraculous ability that she learns in book one to walk in the sunlight, and people are trying to kill her for that. Samson is her protector, who is a human who is there trying to help her, and the two of them are on the run because people are trying to kill them. That's our setup. It started, as these things so often do, with a scream. He didn't know his name, though he was certain he had one at some point. Surely he had parents who had loved and cared for him, right? Wasn't that how the world worked? He couldn't remember. If there were parents out there, they had long since abandoned him or had died trying to rescue him. That was the only sound rationalization his brain could fathom for anyone leaving a poor, defenseless child in the hands of monsters like those who held him captive. Monster. He didn't fully grasp the word's import, though no other words seemed to fit his tormentors better. He had long since lost count of the days and nights of torture and experimentation that had been heaped upon him. The pain, once so unbearable, he would rather die than succumb to one more treatment. Treatment, another word that felt wrong in context. What was he being treated for? Was he sick? Diseased? Was he dying? If not, he wondered if it was worth it. The pain of treatment far outweighed any illness that might have befallen him, though again, he knew no details. The monsters who oversaw his treatment did not talk to him, more like at him or about him, often acting as though he were not there. For a time, he wondered if he had somehow become invisible. A chuckle crossed dry, chapped lips. Wouldn't that be wonderful, he thought. Invisible. How fun. Over time, he became numb to the pain, desensitized. He believed he heard one of the monsters say. Perhaps this word displeased them, because when he returned, so too did the pain. Tenfold. He screamed. His throat scraped raw from the effort. He tasted blood, tried to stop, to close his mouth, to shut down the pain. Nothing worked. For all the pain he'd endured, for all the captors had inflicted upon him, he found a way to bear it, to internalize it, to make it a part of him. He and the pain became one, but this time was different. Unable to control the pain, he screamed again, blood and spittle flying from his mouth, sweat pouring from his body, eyes bloodshot, hair standing on end, uncontrollable, unbearable, inhumane. His muscles tightened against the restraints, the thick, stiff cloth cutting into his skin, skin that felt as though it were on fire. Then something happened. At first, the sound felt far away, a tiny pop against the crashing waves of pain cascading through him. Then he felt his hand move, free. His hand was free of the restraint holding him immobile. Freedom. The word felt so foreign as it bounced around his brain, but there would be no time to ponder its meaning. "He's loose," someone shouted nearby. It was another word that somehow felt wrong, but he understood its meaning. Other shouting voices added to the symphony around him, a chorus of shouts and screams punctuated by bursts of pure chaos. Metal clanged against concrete. Did something fall? He couldn't see. Nearby, a glass shattered. More screaming followed. Suddenly afraid, wild panic set in, clutching tightly against his heart. Moving on instinct and fueled by terror, he lashed out hard. His free hand hit something soft and squishy. Something went pop next to him, and the squishy thing screamed in his ear. He joined in, adding to the scared shouts of the others. That's a good cliffhangery part to end on.
Cliffhangery part, yes. Bobby, I really enjoyed Crimson Moon, the verse part. And when you sent this part, it caught me completely by surprise. This opening was so fresh and such a trusting departure from where we had left Charity and Samson. Mm. And it really brought me in this part. This is called Crimson Nightmare, if we didn't mention it before. So why this opening?
I was inspired by the topic. I remember the topic was science run amok. Yeah. And that I believe the theme in some were,
issue, yeah.
Yeah, I believe somewhere in our earliest discussion, the word like nightmare had some one of us mentioned the word nightmare right. in our back and forth. And that I just thought, what if we start from that? If we start from the nightmare? And I was playing with the science thing. This is whole a science thing run amok.
Yeah.
This is neither one of our main characters, by the way.
But it is science and it is running amok. And yeah, this is really a wonderful tale. Yeah.
Yeah. This is the thing that Charity and Samson are going to run into.
Yeah.
And it seemed like a good playing up that horror. I like the idea of we've all seen that movie or read that story where a monster breaks free and, you know, runs them. It's not a new plot.
No.
Seeing determining how Charity and Samson would deal with it was and the setting. I decided that usually in these type of settings, it's either a dark or it's just a dark place. It's usually at a mountain or some of that. So let's be different. Let's put it out in the middle of the desert.
Right. Yeah.
One place you don't expect a vampire story to take place.
I have time for one more question for you. This is a very modern story with vampires and other very traditional monsters played in a very modern way. What was the thinking or decision making there?
I've written vampires a few times, and even though each is their own separate thing, in my head, there's this interconnectivity that there is a a hierarchy. They're a nation. The vampires are a nation. Werewolves are a nation. There's nations of them. They're out there. They're doing things. They have royal families. They have all this stuff. And so it's playing with that through the ages. How does that work in modern day? Okay, you call them the royal family, but they're more like a business. They run themselves like a business. And they're doing things to try to, they're using the technological advancements of the day to further their cause. And so playing with those things, having vampires and monsters do things that usually it's the science. They've become the mad scientists. And I like the dichotomy of that, of playing the thing that they used to fight against, they have become.
That's cool.
So that's right, funny. So
Bobby, we're going to get back to you a little later. Uh-huh. For those of you who are interested in reading more about Charity and Samson, Crimson Moon is in our, it's really called She's the One, but it's the Nameless Soul Scream. And Crimson Nightmare is in Science Runs Amok. Having put up our blue soul scream lets me kind of segue to Randy, if that's okay with you, Randy.
Sure. All right. Segway.
Let me tell you a little. Yeah, let me segue away a little bit here about Randy Dorn. Randy is a Brooklyn-based entertainment journalist by day, and she says she likes to spend her nights crafting wild worlds of fiction. Her journalism has graced the pages of Variety, the Los Angeles Times, Emmy Magazine, and Today.com. She's also the co-author of the Law and Order Unofficial Companion. And her debut novel, Tune In Tomorrow, is out now. It's been out for a while. And Randy has been everywhere about it. There you go. Great stuff. But for me, she submitted a story that I forget where it was originally published, but I was so grateful that you lent it to us. This was the first, Teal and Alex and Carol had helped me with the teaser, and I knew what I would be getting with them. I didn't really know, Randy, what I would be getting from you. And when I read Rough Beast Slouching, one, I knew the reference, but two, I said, oh, this is going to be the project I hoped it would be, because this story is a fascinating blend of two things I would never have thought to put together. And that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to turn it over to Randy Dawn. Her story is Rough Beast Slouching. It is the unnamed She's the One copy of Soul Scream Anthologine. Randy, do what you got to do.
Sure. Very briefly, Rough Beast Slouching is, it takes place in the sort of Boston independent music scene of the 1990s, which is actually a place I started all my journalism in, and I used to do a lot of music journalism, so that's where this came from. I'm going to just jump right into the story. Basically, our main character, our narrative character is named Nevada. She's got a tough gal exterior, but she's squishy on the inside. And anyway, she's been dragged to see this band play by a friend of hers. And she's just met a cute girl that she might be into. But there's another woman that's also catching her attention for different reasons. So I'm just going to jump into that. It was the woman from the other side of the room, the one playing tonsil hockey with Jordan a few minutes ago. Her arms were gently folded, hip cocked to one side. I wasn't sure if the laws of physics permitted her to get across the room as fast as she had, but I couldn't argue with facts. Unpleasant? I croaked. She said in a clear, lilting voice, if Mr. Elvis Aaron Presley actually were here, he'd be in a rather rotten state. Even a fat man like him couldn't last long after more than four decades underground. How the hell did you get over... I go where I like. She smiled up at me. That needle appeared in my brain, a soft, sliding invasion. When she blinked, I got an up-close look at those unsettling eyes, an earthy, pulsing green, like moss or fungus, something that grows over dead things and consumes them. Greetings, Nevada Sullivan, she said. How? I started again. You may call me Shiri, she said, in a name that reminded me of gauzy things, and oddly of my mom. Now, hush. Lights blasted full on stage as the drums crashed everyone awake. In the sudden bright stood Kay, Puka's drummer and bassist, but no Jordan. I eyeballed where he'd been a second earlier and found him scoping out the area like he'd lost something. Next to me, that something waved a small white hand and twiddled her fingers to the right. Jordan stopped turning around and made a gigantic leap, achieving the stage faster than I imagined a guy his size could move. He gripped the mic like it was a lifeline, and the song kicked into gear. Shiri sighed with pleasure. When it comes to music, there's what I like, and there's what the rest of the world coughs up $100 to see. But this band, the one with the worst goddamn name ever, killed me. Blue Puka weren't just good. It was like somebody took all the music I ever loved in my life and made me see it was just crayon scratches. This was above all that, pure in the ears, straight out the heart type sounds. I was in that moment with the music. Some of it was heart-tearing bluesy, some swampy southern rock, but buried in there was a powerful heart that made me think of the biggest, meatiest bands of the 1970s. But it was Jordan, too. He was this dervish of a frontman, whipsawing this way and that, hauling us all along for the ride through a forest of shiny knives. Kay more than held her own, wielding that axe like she meant to show it whose was boss, doing everything she could to keep up with the singer. She ripped into the chords and flipped those ponytails around and squeezed her eyes so tight her sweat looked like tears. They were a fantastic team, but there was no question of who was in charge. Kay was pretty great, but Jordan had it, that mysterious thing no one could define, but everyone was searching for. Two songs in, though, I started feeling off. The needle in my brain was turning me to jelly inside. Had to be the crappy free beer. I was scoping out the closest exit sign when a hand slipped into mine, locking me in place. All at once, the music was inside me. It went looking for all my soft places and found them and pressed hard until I felt a funny flip all the way downtown. In my good spot, I froze up, then tried to relax into it. But as the song went on, the sensation coiled in me, and there was no release, just a winch turning tighter and tighter. I loved it and hated it, wanted more and had to throw it off me. This wasn't right. This was bad idea, jeans. I thought of Ma, of morphine drips that come after screaming agony. I let go of it all, and the hand slipped from mine. Shiri glanced up, a half smile on her lips. Well done. That was just enough. I bolted for the back exit and vomited in the alley. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, applause, definitely. Can we talk about the two genres that are mixed together here?
I think that we would mix, I think you're referring to like dark fantasy and horror. Are you thinking?
Yeah, but I also say, yes, dark fantasy, yes, horror, but there's definitely rock and roll.
Oh, yeah.
The world of rock and roll. There's a whole genre of fiction that takes place in that world.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Celtic flavor
definitely
mixed in, too. And those, I guess you would say, four things create a story that builds and builds in a wonderful way.
Right.
How did these come together?
So this story actually came after a full novel that I have written with Shiri as one of the characters. The novel is currently on submission, so cross fingers, we might get to see Shiri again in the world, or in that world anyway. But I had written this whole novel and it wasn't going anywhere and I wasn't really sure if it was working. And then I just thought, I want to see the continuing adventures of Shiri.
Okay.
And you know, as sometimes when you write a darker character, I don't like to say villainous with her because she does what she's made to do. She is a she's a fey creature and she's doing what she was programmed to do. But sometimes when you get one of those kind of characters, they're fun to take around into the world. That the good characters, the protagonists and all them, they get their happy endings. They get to go off and do what the story told them to do. But then you're left with these extra characters. And I'm like, I definitely want to see what other havoc Shiri can wreak.
One of the great things about this story and so many stories that I came across in this project is that it's written in such a way that you can say, oh, that's the villain. Mm-hmm. But you can turn the story around and say, wait a minute, they're the villain, which is the horror. And to have that it's open to interpretation, mm-hmm. it was one of the dreams with Soul Scream is that the best short stories I read, I remember there was that collection Primeval. I think it was in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. And so many of those stories I would read and then, you know, read it on a Monday, still think about it on a Thursday.
Yep.
And Rough Beast Slouching is definitely one of those where you can move the diamond and see it from different facets. Sorry for that bad pun, Alex. I owe you $10.
It's okay, bro. It's okay.
Randy, I definitely want to talk more with the whole group, but one more question, because again, we do attract emerging writers, and you straddle two worlds, journalism and fiction.
Yeah.
So maybe you can talk to the difference and the different skills needed and how you go about jumping back and forth.
Yeah, so I actually got into journalism because I thought, oh, somebody will pay me to write while I'm working on my fiction. And the two, I'm not saying that they are completely different, but they do exist in different areas. There are elements of both that can help each other, but primarily, just because you're getting published as a nonfiction writer of articles does not mean that anybody's ever going to want to hear from you as a fiction writer.
They might be in the same family, but it's an estranged family.
Exactly. What I have found with entertainment journalism, it's given me a milieu. Like they say, I finally understood what they mean when they say, write what you know, because I've spent so much time backstage talking to the moot tech and talking to people who make the stuff. And that's given me a real background in terms of where to stage my stories. But what I think journalism mostly gave me for fiction was the ability to be edited. I can appreciate where edits need to go and why in a way that I might not have if I hadn't been doing journalism and getting edited and being told how these things work. So those two things were actually, there are ways to collide these things, but they are different things, and one is no guarantee you're going to get to do the other.
And I have just one quick question. You said the editing was a benefit of this. I was just wondering, would you also say research?
Maybe, yeah. I think that I always researched for my books. It didn't occur to me that I was going to not do some research. The book that Shiri appears in, that Chigan is on submission, there's a lot of Irish fairy and folktale information that went in there, both what Yeats wrote about when he did his whole tour of the country and collected stories, and also the reaction to what Yeats did when he went around the country and collected those stories. So there was always going to be a research angle. I'm not from Ireland. I don't really have any relatives that are directly from Ireland, but I love the music. I love the culture. I love the way that it breathes music in a way that not every other culture does. So for me, that was really exciting. And that required a lot of research because I wanted to do it right. But that was always going to be part of my fiction writing. Research for entertainment journalism, in terms of the time you have to do an article, tends to be a little bit more surfacey, because I don't write for GQ where you get 3 months to write one article and all of that. Yeah, research, definitely. You are correct.
Yeah, cool. All right, so if you hang in for a little bit, we'll have kind of a group discussion at the end, but now it's time.
The T-Man.
To go, yes. Now, last episode, we talked about how Teal has killed and been killed hundreds and hundreds of times, and that he has written over 400 or 500 stories, it's been a week, so maybe it's 600 by now. But he has written pulp and adventure and Jordan Source. There's so many different sides of Teal, you know, it's hard to pin him down. And for Dark Justice, which is our third volume of Soul Scream, Teal gave us a story called Voice of the Desert. And when I was reading it, I couldn't help Teal but think about how much Alex would love this story and how the two of you would start talking about desert war pictures and all that sort of stuff, right? But for me, it was thrilling in a completely different way, because people would be able to argue with me that this isn't horror most of the way through. And then they'd start dawning on, wait a second, it's about the human monster and the comeuppance and stuff like that. And it really helped me spread or make my argument that horror spreads its arms wide and embraces. So, ladies and gentlemen, Teal James Glenn, You can do a little bit of Voice of the Desert, or am I in trouble? Yeah. And I started hyping up the wrong story.
I don't know what you're talking about. I never heard of that story. What are you smoking?
That's a whole different story. Yeah, you ready to go, Teal?
Yes, sir.
All right. So here we go. It's a little bit of Voice of the Desert.
I think we lost him, Major, the soldier said in a hoarse voice. Can't we rest a bit? Major Sir Jason Sidney Jones shaded his eyes with his hand and licked his cracked lips. He looked out along the beach the way they'd come, squinting against the harsh North African sun. The sea was burnished copper in the late afternoon light, and the shadows long from the dunes along the shore. A low, constant wind crawled along the countryside, whistling along the rocks like a muffled moan. I see no one, Jessup, the officer said, but we can push on a bit more. It will get cold tonight. We have to find a hidey hole for our few hours. A few hours, the third member of the group said. He was pale and dressed in rags of what had once been elegant civilian clothes. We move again as soon as the moon is up, Mr. Carson, Sidney Jones said, and we'll rest by day tomorrow. Can't we just rest all night and move out tomorrow? I'm tired. That bloody ball of fire up there, sir, Trooper Jessup said. It'll be better to move by night and sleep through the heat of the day. Only at night? The mornings are bearable, but even not for long if we don't find fresh water, the officer said. He listened while he looked, the moan of the wind all but calling to him in a mocking tone. The voice of the desert, one of the old Egyptian hands had called it when he first came to that parched land, but Sidney Jones had not understood what the man meant then. Now, in the isolation of the vast waste, he knew exactly what the term meant. It was as if the cracked earth were calling out in pain for nourishment, a mocking cry that went up and down the scale like a phantom flute. Those damn Frenchies may just give up on us, sir, Jessup said hopefully. The handsome red-haired major shook his head. Not likely. Murray wants my head on a pole. If we tell what we saw at Jaffa, he left unsaid what they were all thinking, the memory of the horror they'd witnessed in the Mediterranean. The three of them had been part of a British detachment sent to liaison with the Turkish forces in Jaffa. When Carson from the Home Office with them had been sent to help in any way possible against Napoleon and his army. But the little corporal had sieged and taken the city to discover that many of the Turkish troops in that city had given their word not to fight against the French when they'd been given clemency at El Arish. The French troop had kept the small British detachment in separate captivity while Bonaparte and his officers debated for almost a week over the fate of those Turks who broke their bond of parole. The French despot had not the resources to keep prisoners in such large numbers and could dispatch no men to guard them in a prison facility. The most hideous decision had been made of all, to cold-bloodedly kill them all. It was then that the British had witnessed one of the greatest atrocities of the age, when the French had herded some 4,500 men into the surf and began to slaughter them. The unarmed men were put first to shot wholesale, but then the French had decided it was a waste of bullets and began to bayonet and club them to death. The bloodbath took days of butchery that went on around the clock until not a single Ottoman survived. Sidney Jones and his men, all seasoned soldiers in the Indian service, were sickened by the savagery of the deaths. Through it all, the commandant of the prison that held the Brits had leered and laughed at the slaughter. Captain Jean-Paul Murray was a cold and cruel jailer who delighted in his superior position. He shortened their rations and took pains to make them uncomfortable on the journey back to Egypt by ship. But Murray was careless with the guards he posted and underestimated the resolve of his starved and beaten charges. Two of the group had died in the escape, and one had succumbed to his wounds on the swim to shore. But three had survived, and they were more determined than ever to bring the world the word of what had happened. What about water, sir? Jessup asked the officer when the three started inland. We're in a bad way already, and not even a full day on the run. I know, Jessup, the officer said, but we were lucky to make it off that frigate. We can just hope our luck holds out. We'll just take a step at a time, eh? Right you are, sir, the burly soldier said. He had a brawler's nose and a wide smile. One foot in front of the other, eh? The two soldiers shared a smile and straightened up a bit for the civilian's sake. And the officer said, do keep up, Mr. Carson. I think we can find a little rest spot over the next hill.
go. With Randy, we were talking about research, and Randy, I'm going to regret this, but I'm going to unchain Teal. There's some history behind this story, yes?
Yes.
Comes.
A big history buff, and I love the Sharpe's books. And
could you identify the Sharpe's books for people?
Okay. Bernard, what's his last name? Forget, wrote the books about Sharpe, who was an officer in the Peninsula campaign, British Army against Napoleon. And you can't read much of European history and not run into Napoleon left or center.
Sure.
And I thought, in light of modern atrocities, like we talk about the Holocaust and the Armenian slaughter, and this was one of the greatest war crimes ever. They literally just spent 5 days slaughtering these Turkish soldiers. They got bored after a while with bullets and started just clubbing them and stabbing them. And now, it didn't happen in Egypt, but I wanted to deal with the Napoleonic campaign in Egypt. I created this moment of them having been a British liaison troop,
right,
and then get them back to Egypt. But I've always, the other thing I love about history is more soldiers committed suicide in the plains in the United States than were killed by Indians or other soldiers, because the loneliness of being out on the Great Plains in the United States literally drove them mad. They dealt that, they hinted at that a little in Dances with Wolves. And I thought that if you're ever going to be in a place that's going to drive you mad, it's going to be the Egyptian desert, particularly if you come from the soggy isle that is England. And I also wanted to deal with Bernard Cornwall. That's his
name. There he is. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you, little mind in my head. But so I wanted to deal with that, and the fact that really, I completely agree with Scooby-Doo. Ultimately, all the monsters are men.
Yeah.
The most scary.
Oh, yeah. And you really get to see that shade of horror in this. You know, so there's some history. There's the desert, that whole desert military type adventure.
But in the first iteration of this, I actually had some occult stuff, and I said no. And I moved it all out and literally just made it the force of nature.
Yeah.
And conscience that was the monster.
Now, I think that too, with horror, much like science fiction, is great for telling allegorical stories where you can talk about things today in another context.
Whereas the thing with horror is like a seasoning. Yeah. It is literally the pepper. You can add a little or a lot, depending whether you want your people screaming from their throat or just, and like you said, Chris, this doesn't start out as a horror story. It starts out as a rip-roaring, ripping tale adventure on the run from the bad guys. And it goes into that when humans are driven to the edge, they either become monsters or they become heroes.
Yeah.
Really, there's like the two ways you can go when horrible stress is put upon you.
And I think that if people go and read Voice of the Desert, they will get to see exactly the kind of horror that you're talking about. Although there's the human horror of the beatings and the slaughter that we saw, but now the toll that it takes on everyone, the test of the human soul, which brings us back to what Bobby was saying about how horror is that perfect vehicle. That's fundamental thesis to why Soul Scream exists, is because it is so flexible. It is such a perfect vehicle to approach story from almost every other angle.
There's also so many different types of horror. A lot of people, when you say horror, everybody has an immediate, I know what horror is.
Right.
But it can be completely different things.
Oh, yeah.
Horror doesn't have to be a monster. Horror doesn't have to be somebody being murdered. You can have horror in the simplest of situations.
Yeah.
One of the elements, or actually real life situations that I have come across in my readings, that is horrific. And I can't in my own soul imagine what that must feel like. But in terms of the slave trade, there were situations where mothers threw their children overboard to, in effect, die in the water drowning or to be eaten by sharks and then tried to jump themselves.
To drown free.
Yeah,
live in chains. Yeah.
And that's hard. That's just to even reach that point in your soul and your mind where that is an option you're going to go for.
And the fact that that's a true horror.
Yeah.
That's not one of these things we just made up.
No,
that really
happens. And the sad thing is it's not something that happened once or twice.
Yeah.
It happened hundreds of thousands of times. And one of the reasons that I joined the Horror Writers Association is that it is the widest umbrella for any writing group. There is the definition between a crime story and a horror story and an occult story, and they're permeable walls. And I think it's all the more now in our modern times, even though they say, you know, it has to have a genre to put it on the shelf. Most things these days are not one genre.
And that's when they're talking marketing and publicity.
Yeah.
Where they need to categorize something more concisely so they know where to put their marketing money and where to put the ads or the promos to grab the largest portion of audience, you know, attention. But like even fantasy, which is going back to what Randy had, the fantasies that stimulate the mind, there's romantic fantasy. There's, again, the fairy tales and things like that. Then there's the magical ones. Like Lord of the Rings, to me, is pure fantasy. All right. Now, it's got monsters in it, but it's not a monster tale.
Yeah.
It's so much bigger than that.
And even that, he wrote in answer.
Serves so many things, so many possibilities.
He wrote that in answer to World War One. That was his way to deal with the carnage of World War One, so that you can reflect the real world. That's why Rod Serling created Twilight Zone.
Oh,
because
yeah.
They wouldn't let him write about social issues. So he said, great, I'll put him on the moon. I'll make it a werewolf, but it's really about prejudice and it's really about brutality. And that was his mask for it.
To bring you in for a second, Randy, tune in tomorrow, though not, I don't think we would argue that it's a horror per se. Right. But it definitely is one where you blend so many genres. And coming from an entertainment journalist's background, you turn entertainment into fantasy, into social commentary seamlessly.
Thank you.
That'll be $10. Can you talk a little bit about why you chose to do that and where that all comes from, having, again, started from a journalism place to have a day job while you were doing your fiction?
Yeah.
But there's definitely, as Teal and Bobby and Alex were saying, that there's a permeation going on. So maybe you can talk about that. Because I think part of this episode is about genres are not brick walls. We use what we need.
Yeah, I think that keeping yourself into one, like pigeonholing yourself is one of the worst things you can do. There's no reason why you should stick to only one genre just because there's a convenient place on a shelf somewhere to put it, right? In terms of my blending things, the first time I was in the UK, I was doing a study abroad when I was in college. And I think one of the things, of the many things that struck me about the culture over there was how much entertainment dominated the general social discourse. Yes, of course, they have politics and sports and all that, but in such a small country, they were all watching the same TV shows in the way that we weren't, and they were all having the same water cooler conversations, and things were just amped up in a way that for entertainment, from music to television to films, that we didn't really have over here. And I remember thinking at the time, that's probably going to make it to the US at some point. And it didn't take very long. It took the next 10, 15, 20 years. But I feel like our culture now is so involved in entertainment, whether it's news as entertainment, sports as entertainment. No, nothing seems to be just what it is anymore. Everything is a bit of entertainment.
Right.
And that was disappointing in a lot of ways because, yes, on the one hand, it's nice to be entertained. but there's that old phrase about being entertained to death, right?
Opiate of the masses.
Opiate of the masses.
Bread and circuses, keep them busy.
Yeah, exactly. Although I think that was religion that's the opiate of the masses. That's a different kind of entertainment entirely. Yeah. But then, yeah,
and those again, gold robes.
But yeah,
as long as you don't pull off the curtain.
You could say religion too, because there's all these mega churches where they have rock concerts now and stuff. I mean, everything is just constantly entertaining. And at the same time, in more recent years, we've really talked a lot about what is the nature of reality. I didn't think this was a conversation I would ever see in my lifetime or anybody's lifetime, but suddenly everybody gets to have their own version of reality or their own version of facts.
Yeah.
And when I started writing about a reality TV show run by mythical creatures, but starring humans, and they think, oh, this is how humans actually interact with each other. That just gave me a chance to reflect on reality TV and the nature of reality. There's a scene in Tune In Tomorrow, which again, not horror. It's silly and goofy, but it also has a couple of more serious moments. There's a scene where a mythical creature runs into our main character, who is a human actress, and she feels a little bad letting him believe that all of this is actually literally filming humans and their lives as opposed to a great big scripted whatever it is. Yeah. And he very gently says to her, you know what? It's real enough. And I feel like that says a lot about how we mix our entertainment with our reality these days. We're all LARPing, we're all RPGing at all times. And sometimes that's great. I go to a con and people are in costumes and I feel like I'm in this neat little sealed bubble of weird geekiness, but I don't necessarily want every minute of my life to be that. I don't necessarily want the country to be run by people whose main goal is entertainment or getting on the TV. And I feel like we've moved in that direction. And that's my TED talk.
I would add one thing is that one of the nice things about Tune In Tomorrow is it's layers of reality. Mm-hmm. And the main character goes from her drab reality as a waitress who wants to be an actress to living this life and herself going, am I really here? Am I really doing it? And it's some incredibly funny stuff. And someday you have to get Randy to do her dragon voice. The funniest thing in the history of mankind. She is a living puppet.
Your check's in the mail too.
Right. I am reminded very briefly of a science fiction piece that I read years ago, early 20s or something like that, by Clifford D. Simic, called Out of Their Minds. And the thing that was most fascinating about it was, and very briefly, I'll just put it, we're in the real world, things are happening, and this protagonist begins to experience, like he's driving along the highway, and suddenly as he's driving, he sees Mickey Mouse driving in one of those sort of silly symphony type cars on the highway, but it's real, but it's Mickey Mouse. And then suddenly it's gone. And as the story progresses, blips like that start to happen. And what the concept is that mankind or humankind, enough of us began to focus on whatever the fantasy was, or whatever the fiction was, to the point of where that combined energy had created a dimension where those things existed. And now there was a rip or tear between our reality and that one. So we had actually manifested an alternate reality that was now leaking into ours based on consumption. Mm-hmm. How many thousands of people were into this thing, and then that thing becomes real. And I thought, that is wild. And this was like years ago that I was reading that.
And Alex,
that's how we got the Jedi as an actual religion in some countries.
That's what I mean about taking that route, taking the idea of entertainment maybe a little farther than it was meant to be originally. Entertainment is great. You can get a lot out of it, but it's not meant to be the foundation of a civilization. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But we also teach Klingon in colleges.
Yes.
I wanted to talk to you about
that. We both know the guy who created the language. So yeah.
Chris was trying to say something. So I
just want to point the finger back at us, because Randy and you and I may have our hands a little cleaner. But these three here have written so many characters that are deep into the fabric of Americana and the world. We have Green Hornet writers. We have Long Ranger writers. We have Batman, Scooby-Doo. So can we go around the horn and kind of fess up about some of our favorite characters that we've written, because we here, many of us, contribute to that the exact thing we're talking about.
Maybe we can talk about why. We start with Bobby. I don't know that well. Teal and I hate, yeah. And Randy, I know nothing about at all. Yeah.
What? There is a lot of fun to be had playing with these toys that you grew up watching. You can't break them like we do our own characters, but you can certainly bend them. I've been fortunate to do quite a bit of media tie-in stuff. Certainly some, I've done Green Hornet a few times, Kolchak the Night Stalker. That was a pretty big one recently because they had the 50th anniversary. I have a Lone Ranger story coming out. I've done Zorro a couple of times. So stuff like that is fun. I've written Star Trek on an unofficial level, which was, yes.
Produced scripts, my friend.
Yes, yeah. And even though it wasn't like official, there is a bit of this feeling of, I can't believe that when Captain Kirk speaks my words. That's awesome. So playing with characters like that, yes, there's a, you feel a little bit of, I don't know, a reverence toward them. Because I don't want to ruin Zorro. Right. I don't want to be the guy they point to and go, that guy screwed up Zorro.
Yeah, I'm still trying to hunt down some of the people that ruined some of the Sherlock Holmes stuff for me.
Yeah.
And I will find them. I will.
Because I have turned down projects before because I'm not the guy.
Right.
I'm not the guy to write Sherlock Holmes, for example. That's not me. Now, I've done it since then, but I remember turning one down because I'm like, this is not me. I'm going to screw. I don't want to be somebody go, this guy doesn't know Sherlock Holmes. Or the other one was when we adapted an Edgar Rice Burroughs At the Earth's Core into a graphic novel. And there was a big concern on my part because it's a very niche audience, but it's a vocal niche audience.
They all have stone knives.
Oh yeah. And so I was very careful that it was like, I was constantly reminding myself, I am writing Edgar Rice Burroughs At the Earth's Core. I am not writing Bobby Nash's At the Earth's Core. Mm-hmm. It was very important to make sure that the Burroughs-ness of it was there. And so those are the kind of things you think about when you're playing with these, especially these long historied
characters. Iconics. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Bobby, you're talking to two people who have written Sherlock. Mm-hmm. Both Alex and Teal have written Sherlock.
I've dabbled.
I did break it with one of my stories. I wrote a story where Watson is interviewing a bunch of actors because Holmes never existed, and he's hired at this point 6 or 7 Holmes impersonators who've been murdered, and he's changed the ending of the stories to make them not be murdered, and he's going along, and I sent it into Sherlock Holmes magazine. He said, I love it, but I can't print it in this.
We will never.
But that's like the Michael Caine movie.
I only have found out about it afterwards too.
No, no, I'm not saying this. I'm saying they did their thing. Yeah. And not to jump all over, but I'll just quickly rattle off starting with my Sherlock Holmes play. Watson's not in it. Watson's married and he's off doing his thing. We don't need to write that story because it's Victorian England. But I took a reality and then did a fictional story. Ira Aldridge being a black man who actually was an actor in that time period, who came from the United States and went to Europe and became this continental success. What happened to his family after his death had a conspiratorial feel to it. So I took that as a basis and wrote this Sherlock Holmes play. So I tried, like Bobby, I don't want to be the one to break it. I did my homework. Yep. See what I did there, Chris, at homework.
Okay. Did you my can homework. Strike that part of the show, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's. I'll edit it out later. Yeah. And I did all of that, and thank goodness, the Conan Doyle family still had control at that time. So I was dealing with their attorneys or their barristers and all of that. And they liked it so much that they literally, from that point on, gave me carte blanche to do anything I wanted. So I was like, okay, thank you. But then
isn't that a great feeling to be trusted?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yes.
Yeah. Really think about it. But then the other thing was Batman, Tarzan, Superman, Scooby-Doo, Archie, Black Panther, and I'm working on one other Marvel thing right now. And in every one of the circumstances, as you were saying, Bobby, there's that part of you that's saying, what am I bringing to the table? Mm-hmm. What am I going to do with this story to bring it, make it fresh and whatever? But I also have a responsibility because these are not my characters. So how do I handle this respectfully and yet generate some excitement?
And there's, I think it actually helps a bit because you have to be super creative because you can't make lasting changes to these characters unless they hire you to do that. But most instances, if they're going to hire me to write Batman, I can't alter Batman irrevocably. I tell people that writing media tie-ins is like watching Star Trek in the 60s. Almost every episode starts, the Enterprise is flying through space, we're on the bridge, everybody's happy, something happens, some bad stuff goes down, we solve the problem.
Somebody in a red shirt dies.
We're talking beat sheets here now, Bobby, right? Beat sheet.
At the end of the episode, the Enterprise is flying through space, everybody is still on the bridge, they're happy, life is good. That's how you write a media tie-in.
Yeah.
To be fair, if I can just jump in here, I have not written a media tie-in, but yeah, with something like the superhero characters, the Batmans or whatever, there's been 800,000 permutations of Batman. Batman has died and come back. How is it not allowed to do something? Can't we have Batman with his head cut off?
Because those happen.
He's coming back anyway.
But those happen when the company wants them to happen. Uh-huh. If they just say, okay, we're going to do a Zorro anthology. So you're just going to write a Zorro story. I know I can't irrevocably change Zorro. But if they come up to me and say, okay, we want to tell a story where Zorro loses a hand and has to train a replacement, I can tell that story, but yeah. I can only tell that story when Zorro Inc. wants that story told.
Okay, fair. Yeah, I get that.
So it's one of those things where it's what the license holder is asking for.
Mm-hmm. And in their yard.
Yeah. And in most cases, when something like that is going to happen, that's going to be a change, they handle it. They don't just say, who wants to write a story where we kill Batman? They already know who they want to do.
I'll give you another quick example. Michael Uslan wrote Archie Marries Betty, Archie Marries Veronica. That was his concept. He said, wouldn't it be interesting? The owners of Archie, the company at the time, went, ooh, and it's Michael Uslan saying this, suggesting this. So the producers of all the Batman stuff wants to write something for us. Great PR here. Let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing about it is he was never seeing it as this is going to change the Archie universe. He was seeing this as here's an interesting story, a what if kind of
what if story. Basically.
And we get to play with it. And it'll sit somewhere within the realm of the Archie universe. But how the public reacted was really like we had fired off nuclear weapons and obliterated all civilization as we know it. One guy who owned a copy of an original Archie comics, the first one, was worth at the time, I think something like, if I heard right, $40,000 or $45,000. He sold it for 30-something. Because he wanted to get rid of it, because he was so angry that Archie married Veronica. Not that they did stories about Archie marrying either or, but that he chose Veronica.
He was a Betty man. Betty.
And what happened was Michael just hadn't finished writing the Betty segment yet.
Right. Like all those people that went nuts when Superman died or Captain America died. And how dare they? How dare they?
True confession, I dated the official Veronica. For Archie, she won a contest as the official Veronica for a while, so I actually dated her for a while.
Ladies and gentlemen, I stand by my statement that Teal James Glenn has done everything.
Yes,
everything.
But yeah, going back to Soul Scream, which, as I said, I was
that's what we're talking about. Sorry.
Yeah, Soul Scream. No.
Yeah, but I really love when we go somewhere and then come back.
Yeah. What we've just talked about, at least from my POV, what Randy and Teal and Bobby have said, is that we look at material that intrigues us or interests us. We look at what we want to say, our own particular voices, slants, and views on life and whatever the issue or whatever the topic or theme is. And then we dive in with an energy that says we want to do quality work. We want to do our best work. We want to be respectful of the characters, whether we created them or not. The point is to do the best, or as my dear friend and co-host often says, serve the story.
Yep.
And it seems like A, you all do it individually with your own work, but then B, you are able to do it with Soul Scream. Yeah. And so I want to ask one question to all of you, but each one of you take a little turn. What was it like, or what is it like for you to see your work, even though if it was a reprint, to see your work in this collection and to see what this collection looks like? What does that feel like? What does that look like? What has that brought to you?
There are now 35.
Do you want to hunt him down for what he did, or what? What?
He'll be dealt with by the forces of nature. But I got to say, I loved the fact that it wasn't just, I'm going to put a story in a magazine. He approached this from the point of view of, I want to create a sense or a feeling with each book. So it was very much like a curated anthology, but it was not one. It was multiple shapes. So it's almost like he put together an anthology television series where there was a thread going through it all.
Right.
So it built to something. And to me, that was the most fascinating part about this. Is,
well, it does
obviously, and I will say, when he started this, it was going to be, I'm going to do 3 issues. And it grew like an amoeba become this 6 issues is going to be now.
Yeah, well, it's going to be 6 volumes. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what he says now.
We'll talk next week. It'll be 9.
But
this arc will be 6.
Because
and then we'll see what we still need to do.
Shut up. So we can hear the compliments. Come on.
It became something more than what he started with. And I think that's when you know you have something, when it organically grows. It becomes something else. It's the sum of the parts, or the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. That's the phrase that I couldn't remember.
Well, it says it right here on the book. Welcome to the horror con you can hold in your hand. Yeah, I think too, when I first talked to Chris about doing something, you could also tell, because putting an anthology together, there was a lot of passion on his side of what he wanted to do. Because he had to explain to me what an anthologine was.
Yeah.
So Eck had an idea, but there was a passion for what he was doing. I get that he was trying something different. And a lot of times when you go into anthologies, a lot of the times it's a gut feeling. I'm sure this is the same with him, because we both do a lot of anthologies. Sometimes it's just a feel of, ooh, there's something cool here. Or, ooh, there's something, I want to work with somebody here. Or this will be fun. It's one of those three things almost always for me. And in doing this, because my original plan was just to do the one, and that was it. But it's like, it inspired, oh, I want to do another one. Can I do another one? And yeah, so that kind of, that passion for the project really bleeds through. And it was fun. It was fun. It was fun to revisit these characters I created a long time ago. And so, yeah, so that's a lot of times it focuses down to those three things. And in this case, this looks like it'll be a fun time. And I got to say, I get a lot of compliments. The covers are awesome.
Yep.
So.
Yep.
Thank you very much. That's nice.
Yeah, mine was just a reprint, and Chris reached out, and I was like, I love being in on the ground floor on something cool, and this sounded super cool. I love the idea of it being neither fish nor fowl, but also both at the same time. And yeah, it just sounded like a really exciting idea. And the story had been printed once before, as Chris noted, in a place called Dim Shores Volume 2, and it was an expensive book. It was not something that I could go and buy copies and expect to be able to sell. And I was very happy to finally get it published, because it had been sitting around for a while in various forms. But when Chris came along, I was like, yes, I will totally leap on another chance to get this in another publication that more people will actually buy, because Soul Scream isn't free, obviously, but it's a lot
very more affordable.
Very affordable.
For the amount of material in it, it's really affordable. Yes.
Absolutely.
That's the point. Yeah.
So I'm so thrilled that more people are getting their hands on this story, because I'm excited to hopefully, like I said, get another story with her in the universe and just being able to tell people that this story came out. I originally wrote this story in the 1990s. That's how old it is. Yeah, it was a very different version. It's gone through a lot of different rewrites and such, but there was a version of this that came from the 1990s. Out in the world, you never know when a story is going to finally get to see a light.
It feels alive and fresh.
You're here. You're here. I often tell my students, the purpose of an idea is to be an idea. You jot it down, you put it away. Maybe you'll use it tomorrow. Maybe you'll use it 10 years from now. But don't judge it the moment it comes out, because that's not its job.
Sometimes it has to percolate.
See, like they say, if you can have two ideas and rub them together, they start something.
Chris, you want to say anything? Because we are coming on to the hour.
Yeah, one, of course, thanks for everybody for participating. But I do tend on this show to just ask that one more question. And
of course you do.
If the three of you could speak to our audience and you only had time to give them one bit of advice about sticking with it, or it's sometimes a pretty steep mountain and it's challenging to keep at it, what might you say to encourage them to continue pursuing, even in the face of, I'm not a superstar yet. That's really not why we're here, but right? We're here for the story. But what might you say to them?
I would write for yourself. You're the audience that write the story that you want to read. And hopefully other people will eventually want to read it. And if they don't, you've still got a story that you want to read. The industry, the between writing and the industry, it's so vanishingly small that people get noticed even beyond just their usual little friend group. And you have to be doing it for yourself first. And if you're not, then you're not really, I don't think that no matter how much success you get, that you'll really enjoy it.
Absolutely. I was going to say write for yourself. The other part of it is the art is different than the business. Live for the art and then try to get better at the business. But live for the art, because that's what will sustain you when the business isn't.
Yep. Yeah. And I would add to, if your goal is to do this as a career, because not everybody who writes wants it to be a career. Some people write as a hobby. Right. Nothing wrong with that.
Right.
So know what you want. And if your goal is to write as a career, I see a lot of people, and I was as guilty of this early on. I would set this, okay, my first goal is New York Times bestselling author Bobby Nash. Okay, that's goal number 100. That should not be your first goal. Set attainable goals. And then celebrate when you make those goals.
There you go. Know?
Because if you celebrate them, that releases a little bit of endorphins and you're happy, and it spurs you to want to do more. And they don't have to be, like I said, small goals. You know what? I finished a book. That's a goal. And that's a biggie, because for every one of us that finished a novel, there's 1,000 people that are still working on chapter one that will never get to chapter two. Mm-hmm. So set those goals, decide where you're trying to go, and just work at it. Don't think, if I start writing today, I have to sell 10 million copies of my first book, because you're going to be very disappointed.
And don't set a deadline.
Yeah.
Good Lord. You just never know.
Yeah. If I don't make it by the time I'm 30, I'm done.
Enjoy the journey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because in most cases, especially at indie levels, some of us don't get our first books published till we're in our 40s, sometimes 50s.
True.
I know authors who are big names today that sold their first book at 48, 49. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's no timetable on when it is. And you're going to keep learning as you go. You're going to get better. Anything else, practice will make you better. You will become faster at typing. You will become better at story structure, it's whatever. Doing it will make you better.
And listen to people who you respect if they give you a critique. Right. The first hardest thing for most beginning writers is any critique they get, they immediately take it as if it's an attack.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's not.
It's not. And the best way to do that is want to be angry for 15 minutes and look at it and say, how can I use this to be better?
It was like Randy said earlier with editing.
Yeah.
That is very hard for a lot of, especially early on. The first time, editors are not your enemies, but the first thought, you think I'm being attacked. And they just want it to be better. They want to help you get better.
And I think that's partly the language that we use with editing. Mm-hmm. You need to fix this. You need to rewrite this.
Yeah.
And I always try and encourage them to run to that, because that's where the next level of writing is. It's the way in.
A friend early on who really set me right, when she read my stuff, her critiques would be, do you really want to say this?
Mm-hmm.
It's the best way you could say it. She never said, this doesn't work.
Right. Or, I don't understand this. Or, am I missing something?
Right. Yeah.
Because we as writers, we know what we're trying to say. So even if we don't type it out correctly, we know what we're trying to say. So reading it over, our brain fills in the gaps. And so someone else to read it and go, I'm not sure what you're trying to say here.
Yeah.
That is,
I would only, not contradict, but I would add as an addendum to this, like with a lot of emerging writers or aspiring writers, and again, we are talking about people in the early stages of this journey, sometimes they don't know what they don't know.
That's
and
true. So
sometimes what I will say is, all right, help me understand where you're going with this, right? When the character said such and such, what were they feeling? What were they thinking? And I try and get them to go deeper into it, because a lot of times it's about not writing to plot, but writing to character.
Yeah.
And once they start to realize, oh, so we are reflecting aspects of life. So a real person might say this. So my character could say, exactly. Mm-hmm. Now roll with that. Run with that. And the other word, because Bobby was talking about, and Chris also talking about choices of words, I tend to say, so what can we do with this? It's the attitude that you approach it. It's not, oh God, I'm going to have to work hard on it. Let's play with this. Let's see what we can make happen.
Yeah. You're not fixing it. Really, you're not fixing it. You're making it better.
Yeah. Chris?
We could continue forever on these kind of conversations. We definitely could. Yeah. But it's
going to be your first 2-hour show.
All right, so let me help you out here.
You're such sweet sorrow.
No, everybody's coming back. Teal is always coming back. We've changed locations. We put locks on the door. He still keeps popping up.
Yeah.
But Randy and Bobby, please, can we get you back at another time?
Absolutely.
Nah. Come on.
Anytime.
I'll show up at the opening of an envelope.
As your next projects come out or whatever, and drop us a line, and we're always really eager to talk about the new stuff. Snow Hunt by Bobby Nash, ladies and gentlemen. Or tune in tomorrow. You can still pick that up because it's fresh, baby.
And it's fresh the second time you read it, too, because it really is delightful. You get that's a lot more stuff of the jokes.
Yes. Hey, if you do read it, make sure you contact me afterward, because there's an epilogue chapter I couldn't fit into the book, and I will send it to you.
Hear that?
Oh, that's fantastic. Bonus? There you go.
A little bonus.
And one of the things we really don't say enough is that during this episode, Teal wrote 3 new stories. go just look up Teal James Glenn and see what's new, because there's so much great stuff.
Right. We'll put your websites or whatever contact information that you guys want into the comment section, so that folks, if you want to find these wonderful people and learn more about them and the works they're doing, look there. And if you don't give me that, then blame them, because I'm certainly willing to promote them.
There you go. All right. So again, thank you very much. And thank you for letting our audience see how you tell the damn story. We really appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Thank you
so much for being soul screamers.